Did you say die, or did I misunderstand that?
I did say die. Kids die from fatalities related to child abuse and neglect.
The governor's office pushes for more funding for children's services. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, more women in Alaska are smoking marijuana while pregnant.
I asked my mom, and she actually admitted that she did it while she was pregnant with me and my siblings.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
The Walker administration is pushing for more funding for the Office of Children's Services in response to the growing number of foster children in the system. A line added to the governor's new budget would accept $1 million in one-time federal funding that could be used to add more frontline social workers. OCS Director Christy Lawton described it as a life or death situation when questioned by Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra at a House Finance Committee hearing on Thursday.
Christy, did you say die, or did I misunderstand that?
I did say die. Kids die from fatalities related to child abuse and neglect.
Since Governor Bill Walker first introduced his budget, the number of foster children in Alaska has grown from 2,400 to 2,500. Meanwhile, the Office of Children's Services is operating with 25% of its frontline positions vacant, and with each worker's caseload at double the recommended average. Finance co-chair Mark Newman, a Republican from Big Lake, expressed concern about the staffing problems at OCS, but he also had reservations that the state was growing the department with funding that might disappear.
And so we're adding positions, 10 positions here, because we're getting temporary funding for a year. Well, we don't know if we're going to get those bonus funds in future years.
Budget Director Pat Pitney said the governor's office was willing to fund the new positions with savings found elsewhere in the department. Lawmakers have approved an audit of the state crime lab to see if it is properly managing evidence. Senator Berta Gardner made the request of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee on Thursday. The Anchorage Democrat filed a bill to audit the processing of rape kits in the state earlier this year after a report by the legislature's research department was unable to get information on the number of untested kits.
And all of the answers were unknown, unknown, unknown.
The bill is still in committee, but Gardner said she started getting calls from current and former crime lab employees alleging mismanagement. That pushed her to request an audit on the lab itself.
There were claims, for example, that one whistleblower that she'd worked as a lab technician for almost 10 years but left her job because she was afraid of losing her national accreditation because of management's failure to maintain a proper chain of custody with evidence and failure to adhere to standards for storage of evidence.
At the same meeting, the committee also requested an audit of the cruise ship head tax and the way the revenue was being used, and an audit of the Department of Fish and Game's advisory committee process. The Republican legislative leadership is also continuing negotiations with Democrats and Walker over the new budget. While the legislature is scheduled to reconvene its special session in Juneau on Tuesday, they plan to immediately gavel in and out without action because a budget deal has not been finalized. About 1 in 14 Alaska women are using marijuana while pregnant. That's based on the state's Pregnancy Risk Monitoring Survey, which hundreds of new moms complete each year. Between 2002 and 2011, the number of women reporting marijuana use during pregnancy more than doubled. The women are more likely to be younger and have lower incomes. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
What? You want to be interviewed?
And if at any time, yeah.
This is Juno Mom.
We're withholding her name because she fears she could lose her job this summer working in the tourism industry. She's 26, married, and the mother to a baby boy.
Everybody comments on his alertness and how he just smiles and laughs. And he's only 2 months old, but he's very smart. I'm sure everybody says that about their baby.
During her pregnancy, Juno mom smoked pot about 2 times a week. She says she didn't experience any nausea while she was expecting, but she did have painful cramps.
So I would smoke to get rid of those because you can't really take any other medication for it, which worked for me because after I would smoke, my cramps would diminish enough and I could go swimming or I could go on a walk.
She says she didn't start smoking pot until she was in college. And now smoking it recreationally is just more conducive to her lifestyle.
I enjoy marijuana a lot more than alcohol. Like, don't get me wrong, a cold beer on a great sunny day like today is amazing, especially if you can be on top of a mountain. Like, nothing beats that. But I'm kind of done binge drinking and partying hard on the weekends.
Instead, Juno mom likes to do yoga. Hi. She's interested in living a healthy lifestyle and doesn't smoke tobacco. She pays for private health insurance and enjoys spending time outdoors. She says before getting pregnant, she used cannabis medically to soothe her fibromyalgia.
Smoking marijuana like really helped me get over that hump because I didn't have to be on Xanax and Cymbalta and all those crazy mind-altering drugs. So that's kind of when I really started.
But smoking pot prenatally wasn't a decision she says she came to lightly. She did her own online research. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services recently issued a fact sheet on marijuana use during pregnancy and breastfeeding.
Well, there's a lot that we don't know about marijuana in terms of harms or possible benefits, but I think right now the data point to harms.
Dr. Jay Butler is the chief medical officer for the department. He says THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, can enter the bloodstream of a developing fetus or nursing infant.
There are a number of epidemiological studies that suggest exposure to marijuana early in life, particularly heavy use, may affect brain development and intellect. Is it proof of causation? Not necessarily, but I think the data are strong enough that there's reason to be concerned.
So to me, the data wasn't really solid. It didn't provide enough evidence for me to really go with that.
Juno mom says before she made the decision to smoke pot while pregnant, she needed the advice from one more person.
I asked my mom, and she actually admitted that she did it while she was pregnant with me and my siblings. So that kind of made it, you know, a little bit more okay after, you know, my own research that I had done. I could talk to her about it, and she told me her experience, and, you know, I was like, okay, well, I came out normal, at least I think. So it can't be terrible.
If a medical expert feels like a child has been born drug-affected, an investigation can be launched by the Office of Children's Services. Juno mom thinks that's why more women don't talk about it, because they're afraid.
You hid when you smoked, or you kept it private, and so why would you ever want to speak about it to somebody who might blow the whistle on you.
Since she started breastfeeding, she says she's stopped smoking pot regularly for now. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services says with changing attitudes towards marijuana, there are concerns. The number of women smoking pot while pregnant could continue to go up. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a tour operator in Southeast starts hovercraft excursions on the Taku Glacier.
We always thought, gosh, if we had the right kind of vehicle, we'd like to come back up here and do this better.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The recent killing of two Denali National Park wolves has increased calls for protection of the animals on state land adjacent to the park where hunting and trapping are legal. The animals were shot in the Stampede area near Healy. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Denali Citizens Council and other groups are supporting a request by Anchorage biologist and conservationist Rick Steiner, seeking emergency closure of wolf hunting on state lands in the Stampede area northeast of the park. That's where two animals from Denali's East Fork Pack were recently shot. Wolf hunting is currently scheduled to close there May 31st. Steiner says the latest killings have further diminished the popularly viewed wolf pack.
These are million-dollar animals are worth far more alive to park visitors than they are dead to a trapper or a hunter.
Wolf viewing has declined in Denali National Park as overall wolf numbers have dropped, reaching a record low of 48 this spring, a decline most recently contributed to by the killing of the two East Fork Pack wolves. Chief park biologist Steve Arthur says one was a young male, the other a pregnant female.
That, of course, is a little bit more of a concern to us because pregnant females are an important part of the population here, and we hate to lose even one of those.
Arthur says the park supports reinstatement of a no-kill buffer zone on state land adjacent to the park as a way to help rebound Denali wolves, but stresses that human harvest is just one contributor to their decline.
A number of lines of evidence kind of suggest that prey abundance is part of the picture here.
Arthur also cites low snow winters that make it tougher for wolves to catch moose and caribou. Steiner contests the significance of that, but adds natural factors are a part of the decline that can't be changed.
But what we can change is human hunting and trapping of park wolves.
In March, the Alaska Board of Game turned down an emergency petition calling for reinstatement of a wolf buffer along the park's northeastern edge, a protective zone the board scrapped in 2010. The panel maintained the current situation is not an emergency. An acting director of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Division of Wildlife Conservation, Bruce Dale, says the latest wolf killings don't change that.
Even with the additional two wolves, wolves that primarily inhabit Denali Park are lightly harvested. It's almost entirely an allocation between people that want to view wolves in the park and people that want to harvest wolves outside the park. And allocation issues are the purview of the Board of Game, and the Board of Game has considered this.
The Board of Game is nearing the end of a self-imposed six-year moratorium on considering Denali wolf proposals. Buffer advocates have only been able to submit emergency petitions since the moratorium began in 2010. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The start of the cruise ship season brings a new excursion from one of the oldest tour outfits in Southeast. Allen Marine Tours is set to run hovercraft trips to the Taku Glacier near Juneau starting this week, and some local residents wonder about impacts. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
It's been about 20 years since Allen Marine last brought visitors to the Taku Glacier. John Dunlap is vice president of Allen Marine Tours. He said the company used to go to the glacier with a large catamaran back in the 1990s.
We would get as close to the glacier as we could, which at a low tide was several miles away. And at a higher tide, we could maybe get within a few miles of the face of the glacier. So it was kind of a pretty variable experience.
So variable that Allen Marine stopped doing it after a few years.
But we always thought, gosh, if we had the right kind of vehicle, we'd like to come back up here and do this better.
Allen Marine bought a hovercraft from a Washington company last year and started experimenting with it.
It doesn't matter whether the tide's out or not. You can travel with equal ease over water, or if you've got to pass over shallow water and sandbars, that's fine too.
The four-hour tour includes more than an hour on the hovercraft. Tourists leave from downtown Juneau on a jet-powered catamaran to Lower Taku Inlet, where Allen Marine will have a larger ship staged that serves as the hover base. There, tourists will transfer into an 8-person hovercraft, which will take them close to the face of the glacier, where they disembark for 30 minutes. Hovercrafts travel on a trapped bubble of air. Dunlap describes it as a small barge that sits on an inflated rubber skirt. Allen Marine hopes to have three running this summer. Each one is 22 feet long and about 10 feet wide. Dunlap says they don't make any more noise than a boat of similar size. Ron Moss owns 150 acres on the Taku River. He says he bought the property about 20 years ago because of its direct view of the glacier. He's not excited about the new Allen Marine Tours.
That puts a whole different light on that property of ours. We consider it something very special, but Jesus, if we have to listen to this all the time, it's not going to be much fun.
Moss acknowledges his role in the traffic and noise near the glacier. He's the former owner of the Taku Glacier Lodge. Visitors to Juneau are brought there by float planes.
I had 14 aircraft when I sold out, and we made 8 trips a day with each airplane, so I really can't complain a lot about noise, but we tried to control the noise the best we could.
Moss also doesn't like the idea of seeing people walk near the face of the glacier. Dunlap says Allen Marine has state and federal permits allowing people to walk in that area. Dunlap says cruise ship passengers have already started signing up for the hovercraft tours. As interest grows, Dunlap expects Allen Marine to operate consistent tours within a few weeks. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
This is Victory in Europe Day, the 70th anniversary of World War II's end in Europe. In Washington, D.C., more than 50 vintage military aircraft flew over the National Mall to the Capitol, including B-52 Mitchell bombers, P-47 Thunderbolts, even a B-29 Superfortress, believed to be the last of its breed still flying. APRN's Liz Ruskin talked to one Alaska vet who got a bird's eye view.
That plane can land on the water. Look at that.
People crowded around the World War II Memorial and the Washington Monument to see the planes fly overhead in 15 formations, one every minute or so. On the Capitol grounds, tourists mixed with congressional staffers and school groups. Donna Crum of Chicago said she was waiting for the B-17 to honor her father-in-law's service.
So I'm shooting images to my husband to be able to show him on his phone. And here they come.
Overhead in the second B-17 was Alaskan bush pilot Urban Rahoy, a homesteader, lodge owner, and Fairbanks businessman. Rahoy answered his cell phone shortly after landing.
Yeah, right up in the front there, the bomb site and all that is, so I could see better.
Rahoy flew the B-17, the Flying Fortress, in the war, and he flew one again a year ago. He wanted to be at the controls for the Washington flyover, but somebody imposed an age limit of 80. Rahoy is 96.
But I be kicking because I flew yesterday with him, and the guy that flew it made a hell of a bad land. He bounced pretty bad 3 times. And then the guy that flew it today, he bounced and slammed it down pretty hard. They won't let me fly it, though. I come in smooth.
Visibility wasn't perfect, but Rahoy says it was still a beautiful day.
But when we flew over the capsule there by the Reagan Airport up there through the towers and everything, you could see good. There was lots of people on the ground. It was packed pretty heavy.
Rahoy is headed back to Alaska soon. He's got to start some dirt work at his lodge near Tok. Yes, he's still flying a Cessna 206 and a 182. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2015. Find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message is sponsored by APU.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Kayla DeRoche. This week on AK, Samurai Musher. If you didn't hear the rendition of the Alaska flag song by a Japanese choral ensemble last week at Anchorage's Alaska Performing Arts Center, you missed something special. The finale of the musical play Samurai Musher brought the audience to its feet to sing along with the cast. The play told the story of Japanese musher Jujiro Wada, and as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, Although the curtain has come down on the play, Wada's story is still unfolding.
The thread that connects the generations may get tangled for a while, but it is never broken. Although it is said that most Americans cannot trace their family further back than their grandparents, sometimes, no matter how tenuous the connection, the previous generations will find you. That's what happened to Heather O'Hare when she got some unexpected news.
My then boyfriend was actually teaching English in Japan, so I had already purchased a ticket, and I walked into my room one day and my dad comes up and he says, "Hey, remember those times you always wish you were Japanese? Well, be careful what you wish for, because it just came true."
As the audience filed out of the theater, O'Hare, from Modesto, California, tells how she found out that her great-great-grandpa was not only a famous Arctic adventurer in his day, but that he was Japanese.
And of course, I didn't believe it at first, and then super stoked afterwards.
O'Hare says neither she nor her family knew of their connection to Wada until about 10 years ago when a cousin, Rick Medeiros, did some research.
Well, I was told the story, and I got a hold of people in Japan. I got a hold of people in Alaska, the Yukon, and also a couple other states.
Medeiros, from Lodi, California, and a great-grandson of Wada, is considered something of the family historian. He located the Japanese author of a book about Wada, which had been translated into English by a historian in the Yukon. That research revealed the family link that had been buried for almost a century.
Most of the information I've received has been from Canada, the Yukon Territory.
How do you feel about this play?
Well, we've been with them all week, and they're very, very lovely people, and they're very proud. So are we. He was an amazing musher and also an amazing runner.
Wada mushed marathon distances and ran marathons, too, for cash prizes. One scene in the play takes place in 1907 in Nome's new arena. The play, in brief vignettes, tells of the ups and downs of Wada's life, from his first trip as a stowaway from Japan to San Francisco, and his rise to prominence in a pre-territory Alaska as a dog driver renowned for his courage and skill. Musher Wada's exploits were followed in newspapers of the time. He was even commissioned to blaze a trail from Seward to the Iditarod goldfields, and reporters went along to record his progress. But at one point, just before World War I, he was falsely accused of being a Japanese spy and faced discrimination as a result. The accusations ruined his reputation in the new Alaska Territory. Wada went to work in Canada's north, living on Herschel Island off the Yukon's Beaufort Sea coast. It is said that he mushed dogs as far as Winnipeg. He married into an Inupiat family and had a daughter, Himeko. But eventually, he went back to California, where he died in 1937. Somewhere down the decades, Wada's story was lost to Americans, but through the efforts of a Japanese society that memorializes his name and Alaska and Yukon historians, Wada is finally getting his due in the land of the midnight sun. O'Hare, Medeiros, and several other family members from Japan and California were special guests at the Alaska performances of Samurai Musher and traveled with the cast. It took 4 years of planning to get them all together in Alaska. O'Hare says since her trip to Japan 9 years ago, the distant relatives stay close.
It was a magical experience, and we have kept in touch over the last 9 years, and it's been a reunion.
The play was presented in Seward, Anchorage, and Fairbanks this month. The musical was brought to Alaska by the efforts of the Jujiro Wada Memorial Society in Japan and the Asian Alaska Cultural Center in Anchorage. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Michelle Troll, who's lived in Ketchikan for 3 decades, even though she always pictured herself making a life in a big city, like Seattle.
I was going to come here and live here for
a couple of years. I continued to apply for jobs elsewhere. And then I met my now husband, Ray Troll, and he had no interest in moving back to the lower 48. So here I am, 31 years later. He walked into the newspaper and asked about getting some work done there. And then I would run into him at various other places around town. And he asked me out to lunch one day, and we were pretty much together every day after that. Once we got together, we were more or less staying in the state of Alaska. We looked around the state of Alaska for other places to move to, Homer, Sitka. Anchorage was never really an option, Juneau. But what happened was we ended up finding a house that we loved in town. And we moved into that house, and we've lived there for 23 years. I guess the thing that really hit me when I was living in Alaska and maybe struggling with thinking I would rather live elsewhere was we had some close friends that had moved here and lived here for 3 years, and they just couldn't stay any longer. They needed to go back to because of work. And they were so sad, and it really dawned on me that we're really fortunate that we actually get to live here and it works for us here. And there are so many other people who would really like to live in Alaska, but it just doesn't work for them.
Michelle Troll lives in Ketchikan. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ellen Lockyer, Ann Hellman, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Jenkins and Lisa Fu in Juneau and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.